Dominic.
Katie.
This is a bit of a special episode, and I want to start with a confession. I just want to get it out of the way.
Go on.
You know I'm a big fan of the general idea of Europe, right? Like, we've been making this podcast for a while now.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's why we're doing this.
I've never actually voted in a European election before.
Shame on you.
I know. I mean, this is the thing. You and me are, like, really interested in Europe, and I still know, like, nothing, really, about how the Parliament works, and that is kind of shocking. Can I just say in my defence, and it isn't a very good one, I'm not alone in this. Like, a majority of Europeans could not be bothered to vote in the last European elections 5 years ago.
Yeah, but you studied politics.
Yes, that's true. But the overriding feeling was that A, can't be asked, and B, can't really see how this affects my life that much. Like, love Europe, don't really know what they do in Brussels exactly.
Well, I appreciate your honesty. I bet you're not the only one who's done this. But hey, there are elections coming up very soon, so you're going to vote in these ones, aren't you?
I am. So I've had a bit of a change of perspective in that these are probably going to be the last European elections that I ever vote in as a British person, for obvious reasons. So they're my last as well as the first. And it kind of feels like my last chance to get to grips with what the European Parliament is and how it works. And how Brussels works in general, actually.
This is actually the first in a series of special episodes where we're going to be looking at the different European institutions, one episode at a time. This first episode, I'm sending Katie into Brussels to have a look at the EU Parliament because I don't really know what happens there, and neither does she at the moment. And hopefully she's going to find out and tell us why it's important that we vote. Or maybe she'll find out that we shouldn't vote and it's not important at all. I don't think that's going to be the case.
I mean, there's a couple of things that I do know already. I know that these are really big elections, the second biggest in the world after India's. 374 million people have the right to vote in them. And they are so big, these elections, that it's taking 4 days to get through them. So it's going to be May the 23rd to May the 26th, depending on what country you're living in. Other than that, don't really know much, but I'm going to go to Brussels for the first time in my life and try and come back with some answers. What questions do you want me to come back with answers to?
I kind of want to know how decisions are made, like to what extent decisions are top down and to what extent MEPs themselves are able to come up with proposals. That's kind of basic, but can you find that out for me?
I can do that. What are your preconceptions right now of how the European Parliament works?
My preconceptions are that it's like a place where lots of people talk and not a huge amount happens because it must be really difficult to get anything passed. And I don't totally blame the MEPs, or not all of them, for that because it must be really difficult. But my preconceptions are that they're like struggling to find relevance and to find their own power.
In my head, it looks a bit like, this is a kind of nerd reference, but you know in Star Wars, the kind of big, I don't even know what it's called, like the big space
Death Star.
Senate. No, there's quite a lot of like really boring politics bits in the newer Star Wars films where they have like council meetings and there's just like hundreds of aliens all sitting there in their little chairs.
You mean the Jedi Council?
How do you know all this? I didn't know you were a Star Wars nut.
I just Googled it.
Okay.
So basically, we want to find out whether it's more like the Jedi Council or more like the Death Star.
Yes, no. I feel like if anyone's the Death Star, it's the European Commission. But anyway, like that is what it looks like in my head.
Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour. Je suis Midi, votre chef de bord. Bienvenue à bord de ce Thalys à destination de Bruxelles Midi. Prenez garde à la fermeture des voies.
So, I get on the train from Paris to Brussels. And while I'm on the train, I start brushing up on the basics so that I don't look like a complete moron when I start bumping into like EU policy wonks.
How will you know if they're policy wonks?
Because I've got glasses on. I don't know.
Is there a uniform?
Yeah.
Like, is there a specific type of person you expect to see?
Glasses and like blue long sleeve shirts. I don't know. I mean, I've never met them. This is the whole point. But if they were to start quizzing me on how many seats there are in the European Parliament, or if they were quizzing you, would you know the answer to that?
No, I have a feeling there's like around 700.
Yeah, not bad. So currently 751, and in theory, they're going to shrink it down to 705 after Brexit. But let's not talk about that right now. So obviously every country in the EU has seats in the parliament, and the number that they have is roughly proportional to the number of people that live there.
Seems to make sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. But it's weighted a little bit in favour of the small countries to make sure that they don't get drowned out by the big ones. So Germany gets the most because it's the biggest country. It's got 96. And then it goes all the way down until you get to a few countries which have just 6 MEPs.
Like Malta. No, Malta's not in the EU. Sorry, I didn't say that.
Malta is in the EU and it has got 6.
It does have 6. Was I right?
Yes. Oh my God. Congratulations, Dominic.
Thank you.
The other thing I'm reminded of as I'm sitting on the train is the fact that the parliament actually meets in 2 cities. So it meets in Brussels, as we all know, but it also meets in Strasbourg, which is this beautiful little city on the border of France and Germany. And that's where they actually go to vote on stuff. So every month they decamp from Brussels to Strasbourg for 4 days, which is this massive palaver. And it's really expensive. And most MEPs hate doing it because it's really tiring.
Why? Why do they go between?
Well, a lot of people think the whole thing is completely pointless. But the reason it was given the base there in the first place is because the city was this really important symbol of peace between France and Germany after World War II. So it's quite symbolic of like how the whole European project is a peace project. These days, most MEPs just want to get rid of the Strasbourg bit because they spend insane amounts of time travelling.
Wow, it sounds expensive.
It is expensive and bad for the climate. But yeah, it's very sensitive and the French government gets very cross at any suggestion that they get rid of it. But back to my train journey, I am speeding through the very flat Belgian countryside. And as I'm doing that, I'm trying to get my head around the voting systems that are used to elect all of these MEPs. And that's where it gets a bit complicated because it turns out every country gets to decide what voting system it wants to use. It has to be some version of proportional representation. But apart from that, they can kind of do whatever they want. So there's a few different ones being used.
I seem to remember there's like a really complicated version, single vote.
Single transferable
thing
vote.
In the UK. Single transferable vote in the UK, is that right?
Well, Dominic, we actually use 2 different systems in the UK. Single transferable vote in Northern Ireland and this really fun system called De Hondt, which is named after a Belgian mathematician. And it is so complicated that it gave me palpitations sitting on the train. So if you're listening from Britain, I promise that you will get your head around it eventually, but you might have to go and sit in a dark room for a couple of hours.
I remember learning about these at school, the different types of proportional representation. I actually quite enjoyed it.
You're a nerd.
For a while, I had like a preference.
Did you? What's your favourite voting system?
I think I did approve of the single transferable vote.
Listen, we could be here till midnight going through like how our listeners in Spain are going to be voting as opposed to our voters in Denmark. So what I recommend is that everyone just Googles the voting system for the European elections where you live and yeah, just spend a minute or two getting your head around it. But yeah, I spent quite a large chunk of my train journey trying to understand the De Hondt voting system. And that was so exhausting that I basically spent the rest of my journey looking for Star Wars clips to send you to show you just how administrative and boring loads of it is.
I object to the Senator's statements.
The Chair has not recognised the Senator from the Trade Federation at this time.
To state our allegations.
Game begin.
So, I get to Brussels. First impressions, nice place.
And was it full of people in blue shirts?
Yes, just wonks. And actually, the first person I went to see, I don't think he'd be too offended by this, but I'm going to call him a wonk. He's a Danish guy called Pelle. Pelle Gertsen is his name. And he's this very smiley, jolly guy. And I've been told by a friend, if you don't know anything about how the European Union works, go and see Pelle. He will sort you out. Pelle runs a consultancy firm called Eurofex, so explaining how the EU works to outsiders is literally his full-time job. And the thing that's really great about him is he used to run the office of a Danish MEP, so he has really intimate knowledge of how everything works, but since he doesn't work there anymore, he's not going to sugarcoat everything and tell me that everything works like clockwork in the European Parliament if it doesn't.
One of the interesting things is that nobody wants to help you. Everybody keeps information as if it's the most precious thing in the world, and they keep it to themselves. And it can be important information, but it can also be ridiculous information, like how do you use the photocopier? I mean, it is a political environment, and you always have people that are vying for their next job or thinking that they need to shine even more. So that struck me as odd.
Oh, wow. So it's quite cutthroat then.
Very.
That sounds horrible.
It is a bit sort of House of Cards-y. Pelle was a really good first person to meet inside the Brussels bubble because he just explained how everything worked super patiently. very quickly while chatting to him, it became clear that in some ways, the European Parliament works just like any other parliament in a country. It's just on a much bigger scale. So on a really basic level, the MEP's job is to debate and pass laws that they think will make life better for all of us. And just like a normal parliament, it's made up of parties with different ideologies about what would be better for all of us. But because everything's on a bigger scale, those political alliances are international. So you've got like socialist MEPs from across the continent who all work together. You've got right-wingers who all work together. And that way it's quite a lot like a standard parliament.
I've always thought that it must be an absolute nightmare for these groups of parties to work together, because you think about the Labour Party in the UK or the Conservative Party and how both of them, even within themselves, find it so difficult to agree. And that's just like a national party. But when you have all these international parties coming together, trying to work together, it must be a nightmare. Or is it that because there's less scrutiny on them, less of the public eye watching over their decisions, they actually come up with easier agreements?
It does have a bit of a reputation for being slow, because as you say, it's bound to take a while to make decisions between people from 28 countries when you have all of these competing interests, right? But even given that, the way that it works and debates and votes on things will be fairly familiar to anyone that lives in that country with a parliament. But there are a couple of weird quirks to it. And the first one is that there are some policy areas that the European Parliament just cannot touch. It doesn't ever decide foreign policy. It doesn't look at healthcare, it doesn't look at schools, it doesn't look at housing. So there's quite a lot of big policy areas that are really important to voters, but they just don't get decided at the European level. Those things stay in your country.
And that's probably why, when I was talking to some of my colleagues the other day, they were like, oh, well, the EU doesn't really do anything. It's just France and Germany, the leaders of France and Germany, who decide they want to do some things. And then that happens, because they were saying, yeah, well, what's the point in voting in the European elections, because nothing gets done. But maybe it's just that the things that they pass in the European Parliament aren't always the big hitting newsworthy things.
There's definitely a few big things that are off the table, but once you take that stuff off the table, there is still like loads of stuff left that they do get to debate and make laws on. They can make laws on migration and like farming and the environment.
All quite big things, I guess.
Quite big things. Just name check quickly a few things that we have in Europe, partly as a result of decisions by the European Parliament. You ready?
Go on.
There's a ban on loads of single-use plastics coming in 2021. So things like plastic forks, plastic straws.
Sounds great.
Cleaner seas, loads of stuff to try and keep air pollution to a minimum. Minimum like holiday, time off work every year.
That's really good. I did actually defend the European Parliament, you'll be happy to hear, but I didn't have as many nice factoids.
You have them now. I'm going to give you another one. Getting rid of roaming charges. So if you've got a French mobile phone contract and you go to Italy on holiday, you don't have to pay a big phone bill for that anymore.
I literally think if they'd made the Brexit debate all about that, people would have been like, oh, fine, yeah, I'll vote to remain. I know it's kind of a glib point, but I remember during the campaign, I was like, why aren't people talking about the roaming charges more?
It's a big thing that actually affects our lives in like a really concrete, obvious way, and it's nice. So well done, European Parliament. They do get to pass laws on stuff that matters. But there is another major quirk to how the Parliament works that makes it a bit different from the other parliaments, and that is that it doesn't get to decide what it votes on. That job is done by the European Commission, aka the Death Star.
Okay, who are basically the executive body then.
Yes, exactly. So what happens is the Commission says, hey, I think we should have a new law on this. And let's say it's like a ban on people called Dominic.
Why?
I didn't suggest it. It's from the European Commission. What happens next is, it depends a bit on the type of law, but in most cases, two different bodies have an equal say over what the law ends up looking like. And one of those is the Parliament, and the other is the Council of the European Union, which is this kind of amorphous body. Do you know what it is?
No.
So it's made up of all the ministers from the different countries for that thing. So if it's an agricultural law that we're trying to come up with, then the council equals all of the agriculture ministers. If it's a defence law, then it's all defence ministers. And in this case, this ban on babies called Dominic, it would be like all of the baby's name ministers.
Okay. And do they all have to unilaterally agree on like some common decision?
So what happens next is the Commission comes up with this idea of banning Dominics, and then the Parliament and the Council, which for this thing are like the baby's name ministers from each of these countries, they go back and forward between each other trying to get a version of this ban on Baby Dominic's that they're both happy with. And usually what ends up happening is that there are like a gazillion amendments and lots of debating. And finally, everyone is just so exhausted that they're like, fine, let's just go with it. This is what Petter had to say about it.
And then we see if we can make something that makes nobody completely happy, but also makes nobody completely unhappy.
I don't see who is going to be made even slightly happy about the ban on Baby Dominic's.
Well, I'd be made really happy by it, but that's just me. It was really interesting talking to Pelle about like how the sausage gets made in Brussels. Because basically what you realise is that by the time all of this politicking has been done and the law actually gets voted on, every European law is such a masterpiece of compromise. They found a version that the MEPs are broadly happy with. They found a version that the national ministers are broadly happy with. So all of those times when politicians at home in Britain complain about the EU forcing us into laws that we don't want, those complaints start sounding a bit hollow, which is actually something that I was chatting about with another friendly Brussels person, Sophia Rusak. She is a German researcher working at the Centre for European Policy Studies, and she knows everything. And this is how she put it.
It's often not happening. What you see a lot is the Brussels scapegoat syndrome, let's say, that national politicians in the council decide things. So, I mean, again, we must keep in mind that every law that is passed is agreed on by the council, which is composed of member states' representatives. So nothing goes through Brussels without the agreement of the member states.
Is it true that then if a single minister for baby names decides that they don't want there to be a ban on Baby Dominic's, they can veto it?
That is a good point, because actually they do have to be unanimous. What's that word?
Unanimous.
They do have to be that for like a certain number of like decisions in quite sensitive issues. But on other stuff, quite a lot of the stuff they use qualified majority voting. And basically what that means is 55% of member states have to be in favour, and those states have to represent 65% of the EU population. Capiche?
Yeah. But therefore you can kind of blame Brussels.
You can, but it is like unlikely. There's been like loads of consultation down the way and like consultation with people in your country on that rule. So by the time it gets to voting, probably it is something that most people are happy-ish with, give or take a bit of grumbling.
And it's just democracy, I guess. Not everyone is happy with every decision.
That is exactly right, Dominic. Sophia was also really helpful when it came to getting my head around like what the makeup of the parliament is in terms of the parties in it. How much do you know about that? Because I didn't know much at all.
What, about the different groupings?
Oh, well, that's a good start already, because I didn't even really know that they were called groups and not parties.
Oh, I did.
Well done.
Although some of them call themselves parties, don't they? The European People's Party.
So, like, who are the European People's Party?
European People's Party are, like, centre-right, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then pretty close behind them, there's a centre-left group called the Socialists and Democrats, which, again, brings together everyone of that kind of ilk from all over Europe.
And what else is there? Green and ALDE.
ALDE, our favourite. They're a kind of centrist, liberal group. And then each of these groups can select what is called, and here comes your favourite word, a Spitzenkandidat.
Whoop.
It's a German word and it sounds a bit intimidating, but basically it just means lead candidate. And all of these Spitzenkandidaten are vying to become the next president of the European Commission, which we will get onto in a future episode. But basically what you just need to know for now is that they are like the international face of the campaign for their political group, which I'm pretty sure most people in Europe have no idea about because these people are not on the news. Do you know who any of them are?
Yeah, Timmermans, no?
Yes, Franz Timmermans.
Franz Timmermans is for the Social Democrats?
Socialists, yep, Socialists and Democrats. Dutch guy, obviously, seen as very powerful behind the scenes in the EU. And one thing that makes him different is he's really good at making like passionate speeches in about seven languages.
Is that political choices have real consequences for real people. These are not games we are playing. As politicians, you have a responsibility. Face up to them. Don't run away when you are scared of the consequences of your actions.
Who else?
Is his name Manfred Weber? For the EPP?
Yep, conservative German guy. You might remember we talked about him before when he released this video saying how proud he was that he used to be in a rock band.
It was because I was a guitar player in a band. I stood in the first row of the band, and that was for me an interesting experience to be connected to people, to listen.
I imagine most people voting in for their MEPs aren't even really aware of what grouping the party that they're voting for is part of, let alone who the Spitzenkandidat is.
Yeah, and to be honest, it is interesting, sure. But like for most normal people who are just struggling to get their heads around how all of this works, I would say like focus your efforts on deciding who out of the options available to you to vote at home are and how the vote works where you are.
Presumably, normally no one grouping gets a majority. I mean, when I say normally, presumably never.
No. What often happens is that the big kind of establishment blocks, so the EPP, the socialists, often kind of club together to get stuff passed. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. Like, obviously, it's very difficult to make predictions right now, but people like Sophia and Pelle are predicting that the new parliament, the big parties are going to lose seats to smaller parties, which is maybe going to make things a little bit more fragmented and interesting.
And slower.
And even slower. So there's 8 political groups in total going from left to right. So there's obviously the ones that we talked about. There's also the Greens. There's a far-right grouping that has parties like the French National Front in it. And then there's this kind of wildcard group, which I find really intriguing. Here's Sophia again.
And then you have the Europe of Freedom and Direct Democracy. The two biggest group in there, which make up this group, are the British UKIP and the Italian Five Star. And obviously, their mindset is very, very different, but they came together to be able to form a group, because if you form a group, you get more funding and you have more more power inside the parliament.
Ha! So they're kind of strange bedfellows, those two.
Yes, they're very strange, and they actually don't really belong together. There's quite interesting research of VoteWatch where they look on voting behavior, and the EFDD group is the group that votes basically never together. Like there's zero coherence. So there you can see that these are very strange bedfellows indeed. Yeah.
What was their name again? The European something for dark democracy.
That's not what they're called.
Oh, Europe of Freedom and Direct Democracy. I thought she said the European Freedom of Dark Democracy.
I mean, that again would be quite Star Wars-y.
Yeah, I was like, it is more like Star Wars than I thought. Nigel Farage is Darth Vader.
He is your father. So that's quite fun. And in general, like once I got my head around the lay of the land in Parliament, this is going to sound incredibly lame, but I kind of got into watching like clips of old debates in the Parliament. Because they're all online, but we don't get to watch them on TV. This stuff is literally never shown on the British news and pretty rarely everywhere else. And in a way, it's kind of like watching footage from any parliament. Like most of it is super dry and boring, but there are these little moments of drama and entertainment that make the whole thing worthwhile. Like there was a time when the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, turned up and everyone basically told him to his face that he was a terrible person.
Oh, that's fun.
It will be impossible today, Mr. Orban, that Hungary can join the European Union.
There was a time back in 2010 when Nigel Farage had this to say to the EU president of the time.
You have the charisma of a damp rag and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk.
There was also the time when a British MEP sitting next to Farage held up this big sign that just said, he's lying to you, with this big arrow pointing towards Farage, which was really fun.
And that's allowed. Or did he get in trouble?
He did get told off for it, yeah.
And it'll slap on the wrist.
So it is more fun than you think. And now that I was armed with this newfound enthusiasm for all the drama that goes on in the European Parliament, I finally felt ready to turn up at its doors in Brussels and smell the corridors of power.
Ooh.
So it is Monday morning and I am outside the European Parliament building. I'm finding it very hard to get into and like find the front door, which is not a great start, but I'm hoping that things are going to improve from here. The Parliament itself is not the friendliest of buildings. It's this big, ugly, sprawling set of buildings that were built in the late 80s. And it was originally intended as a conference centre, so it wasn't purpose-built to become this, like, inspiring home of European democracy. And that does really show. It's really hard to find your way in and navigate, which obviously reflects how quite a lot of people feel about European politics. But luckily, I was met by another friendly face. Everyone in Brussels is like really smiley. It was quite unexpected. Lila Pinter, she's a Hungarian working at the Parliament, and she was sent to take yours truly on a guided tour.
So every single MEP has an office?
Every single MEP has an office. And they also have like...
So we go into this massive 80s looking building, which seems to take about 3 days because of all the security and all of these escalators. But then Lila takes me into the chamber itself. And actually, my first thought is that it doesn't look that dissimilar from the Senate in the Star Wars. It's this big, like, cavernous chamber full of hundreds of blue seats arranged in this big semicircle.
So actually, the chamber is represented, you see, it's in different sections. And so it's according to the political groups, like the Camembert. We have here EPP, Socialist, Extreme Left, and then on that side, Extreme Right.
Okay, so you don't sit with people necessarily from your country, you sit with people in your country.
No, it's according to your party affiliation, actually.
Did she just use a Camembert analogy?
We're in Europe, Dominic. We have to use European metaphors.
I think that's beautiful. And I think maybe it's a kinder metaphor than the Star Wars analogy we've been using up until now.
But I had a quick look around, and then I sat down for a chat with Jaume Duch, who is the chief spokesman of the Parliament. He's quite a stern Catalan guy, but he is quietly proud of all the work they do at the Parliament, even if he is quite aware that MEPs like don't necessarily have the best reputation.
In fact, I was surprised last week when I asked for the statistics about the results of the last 5 years. The Parliament was able to adopt more than 1,000 pieces of law or decisions, which then come with an impact in the daily life of the citizens. And it's amazing because you cannot find another parliament, national parliament in the world probably, which this capacity, this working capacity.
That does sound quite impressive.
That is quite a lot of laws, yeah.
Are they counting each line in a piece of legislation as a separate piece of legislation or something?
They are probably counting some quite niche things, because one of the things I quickly became aware of when I went to Brussels is that a lot of the things that they pass laws on are quite technical things, and that's probably part of why this stuff doesn't make the headlines. It is like quite technical things about like what percentage of pesticides are you allowed to have in like your water and stuff like that. It's not sexy stuff.
But really important stuff.
So Jaume and I had a nice chat about the kind of laws that have been passed by the European Parliament over the past 5 years. And then I've got a bit of a confession to make.
What?
Well, after we did the interview, they just kind of left me in the Parliament without a minder. So I might have gone on a bit of a recce.
This is now the fifth floor. See what's in here.
I just thought I might bump into some super corrupt MEPs doing some, like, dirty dealing. So I just kind of wandered around the building for ages.
That is hilarious. I can just imagine you wandering around, thinking that you look more suspicious than you actually do.
Ooh, I'm in the MEP's canteen. It's nice, I've got salads.
In case you're wondering if I found any super corrupt MEPs doing dirty dealings, I didn't. I found nothing. It was really deeply underwhelming. But it was fun anyway. I just want to briefly interrogate this mental image I had of MEPs as being like a bit corrupt or crooked. I feel like it's something that I grew up with in Britain, this idea that people become MEPs to like take advantages of these really cushy allowances that they don't really work that hard for. Is that a stereotype that you had as well?
Yeah, it is to some extent. Or particularly with, in my mind, the members of Marine Le Pen's party and Nigel Farage's, whichever party he's currently a member of. I just remember hearing reports about them using the expenses badly. But I mean, even if you're using your expenses properly, is it a really cushy job?
It is quite cushy. So the salary is about $8,000 a month.
Whoa, that's loads.
Yes. Well, remember, it is quite a tough job. It's loads of work and there's a lot of travelling. So you've got to be away from home a lot. It is lots of money, though. And then there's the fact that the Parliament has this reputation for being a prime target for lobbyists. So for every MEP, there's about 10 lobbyists who have permanent access to the Parliament. Not that it's all like people who work for big oil or whatever. There's also people who work for human rights groups and like environmental charities and what you might think of as good lobbyists. You do hear stories about MEPs getting handed really nice corporate jobs after they finish being MEPs, and there being a kind of blurred line between those corporate interests and the people who are there representing us. But one important thing to note, because of this reputation for lobbying, the Parliament brought in new rules in January. So from now on, senior MEPs are going to have to publish lists of who they're meeting. But just bear in mind that rule doesn't apply to all MEPs. It's just the ones who've got like important jobs on committees and stuff like that. I didn't really know how much of a big deal to make out of this whole transparency thing. So I turned to yet another person who knows a lot more about how the EU works than I do.
I think my nickname was EU Geek in Chief.
Okay. Are you proud of that?
I can live with it.
Quentin Arias, he is a French reporter. He works for the Washington Post, as well as a bunch of French media. And he was like relatively chilled about the whole thing.
MEPs, like the European Parliament is way much more transparent than the Council.
Okay.
In terms of, for example, every vote is public.
So on the sliding scale of European organizations, it's not terrible.
Yeah, like the information is hard to read, it's hard to access the information sometimes, but honestly, compared to the British Parliament, for example, you have more information on what to do. Like, for example, every MEPs need to disclose the interest. Okay, like Verhofstadt, we know Verhofstadt is a member of a lot of companies, like Farage, I think, makes more money for Fox News than his MEP salaries, but most MEPs actually is 100% the job. So if we compare to maybe the British Parliament, when you can still become a lobbyist and a lawmaker, so it's kind of the same, no? But I think the duty of being more transparent is greater in Brussels than it is in national capitals, because it is so far away that actually there is a duty for MEPs and for institutions to become more transparent.
Okay, so that's the corruption stereotype that I feel like I have floating around in my head. The second stereotype I have floating around in my head is that MEPs are slightly more likely to be crazy than politicians at home because it's like proportional representation, right? Is that fair?
Right now, Brexit is right 70% of my work. Honestly, I've watched the House of Commons debates. They are as crazy as national MPs. This is so weird in the European Parliament, because at the same time you have like a Gordon Down, Greek far-right, even neo-Nazis MPs, and Pirate Party, and you have Nigel Farage, and you have like French socialists and so on. So it's such a weird mix that of course you have some crazy characters around it. And but I'm not so sure. Like, I think they are as crazy. If we take a look at what happened on Brexit and how the Parliament, the British Parliament, was unable to decide on anything. As a constituent, even if I'm not Brit, like, it sounds as crazy as MEPs yelling. When you do politics, you need to be a bit crazy. So that's why, like, you have some 10 to 20% of the lawmakers you're going to elect, which has a tendency to become a bit crazy. But, like,
I love it. You've got a statistic for that.
Take a look at the US. Like, just take a look at, like, in every, like, everywhere you have those kind of things.
Sounds like you've had fun in Brussels, Katie.
I have been having fun. I met really nice people. The bubble is nicer than you think. And you know what? Like, the longer I spent talking to people about how the Parliament works, the more it made me realise that, yes, we can acknowledge that the European Parliament is probably not the most transparent organisation in the world, and it's definitely not the most efficient. But I barely think about these questions when it comes to our national parliament. Like, I don't question whether it's legitimate or not. And it is definitely a really opaque place. Do I know how all of the committee stuff works in the Parliament in London? No. I mean, do you?
Yes.
Oh, you do? Okay, fine. It just made me realise that I've been judging EU institutions by like a higher standard than I do at home.
Yeah.
Probably because it does feel more remote and far away, and because I don't know how it works. And probably because I come from this like really Eurosceptic country, so that's just the kind of stereotypes I've been surrounded by since I can remember thinking about Europe. We are nearing the end of our journey, you'll be pleased to hear. Now that we've finished our journey in Brussels, I wanted to bring us back to one of the edges of Europe. We're going to go to Ireland, because at the end of the day, these elections aren't about Brussels, they're about all of us, wherever we live. So I wanted to tell you about Saoirse McHugh. Saoirse is 28. She is an environmentalist and a kind of small-scale farmer, and she lives on a beautiful little island called Achill. She is running to be an MEP for the Green Party, which in a rural part of Ireland is kind of brave, because the Greens in Ireland are seen as like a party for big cities. And when I rang Saoirse, she and her boyfriend were on their way to campaign at a lambing festival.
A lamb festival.
And literally pulled over by the side of the road to chat to me for half an hour.
Hi, Katie, how are you?
About this beautiful place where she lives, which also has a lot of problems.
When I think about when I was young, everyone had sheep and there was a load of kids around, but very rapidly in the last 20 years, shops are shutting. There used to be a library that would come. Pubs are shutting. Like, the place is just shutting down.
And Saoirse left too, actually. She went away to college. She went to work in America for a bit. But then she decided that didn't really feel quite right.
In England. And every time I'd be away, I would think, I have to move home. Things have to change at home. There's so much that needs doing and so much can be done. Like, there's so much potential in ACCO. And I just feel, not a duty, but I feel like I want to do something.
Saoirse is not someone that ever saw herself going into politics. She is a campaigner. She believes really passionately in the need to fight climate change and to get a better deal for farmers and stopping Ireland from being such a tax haven.
Because it makes me sick.
But the reason that she's running for office is that she finally thought, I can either keep hassling the people in power to make change happen, or I can try and be that person in power. And that is how she's found herself running for a seat in the European Parliament.
And honest to God, I'd never even thought about it. In a moment of craziness, I was like, okay, fine, I will. Because the only reason I wouldn't would be because I'd be so scared. And that doesn't really seem like a legitimate reason, does it, when you say it out loud? I think Europe has the scale and scope to deal with these issues because of the integrated nature of our economies and societies. It will need to be from Europe, a lot of these things. Like, if no green voice whatsoever gets elected back to the European Parliament next year, that'll be a disaster.
One of the things I really like about Saoirse is that she has been campaigning really doggedly out on the streets, even though she's actually really shy and hates doing it.
Oh, that is really brave.
I just want to sit in a room and read policy and nerd out over, you know, coupled payments and stuff like that. Instead of, like, kissing babies and shaking hands.
Because that bit, to me, sounds like the fun bit. You want to do the boring bit.
No, what are you talking about? When, like, getting photos taken, it takes me 40 minutes to recover afterwards. My heart is just, oh, I find it so tough.
So you're very forewarned in terms of all the, like, the committees and stuff like that. You're totally up for that.
Oh, yeah, it sounds awesome.
How nice to hear someone who's enthusiastic about policy documents and wanting to do things and really doesn't like being in the limelight.
She is wonderful. And the reason I really like talking to her is firstly because she is really nice, but also because she reminded me that if we want to, we can fill this parliament with people that really give a shit about the place where they come from and people that really want to solve problems that need international solutions. You know, it's funny, probably despite everyone's best efforts, the turnout in these elections is not going to be amazing. But something kind of interesting has happened over the last couple of weeks, and that is, for the first time ever, the EU has actually produced a decent campaign video about why people should vote. And it's gone kind of viral. Have you seen it yet?
Is this the one that, like, features Brexit in it quite a lot?
No, it's the one about babies.
Oh no, I haven't seen that one.
Today, I'm being born. Like thousands of children all across Europe.
It's called Choose Your Future, and it's had tens of millions of views. And it's all about babies and, like, building a Europe for baby Europeans to live in. And the main message I came away with was, childbirth looks horrible, and I don't think I really want to go through it. But also, we are choosing our future here. And I don't want to get all warm and fuzzy, but going to Brussels and talking to all these people, it did make me realise, in quite a profound way actually, that this election is us choosing our future together as a whole continent.
That's why we vote. Choose the Europe you want me to grow up in.
You have heard this episode from people from all corners of Europe, Irish, Hungarian, Danish, Spanish, German, French. And this is the moment where we all get to choose the people that we want to make laws for all of us.
So I guess the likelihood is, if people are listening to this episode, they're going to vote anyway. But should we, like, try and convince people to remind some people who in their life who might not vote to actually go and vote?
Yeah, that would be really nice.
Is that really patronising?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I don't want to be that smug person that's like, you're a bad person if you don't vote. Like,
well,
I know.
You are a bad person because you've never voted.
I have voted. It's not a European election. I know everyone is busy. We are all busy. But this is a chance for people to have their say about stuff that they want to change. So maybe you live in an area that's been hit really hard by people leaving, like the island where Serge lives, or maybe it's really polluted where you are. You have a chance to have a say on stuff like that in the next few days. And I really hope that lots of people use it.
We have a few people to thank for this special episode of The Europeans. It was made with help from the European Cultural Foundation. They support initiatives which are rethinking Europe as an open and democratic space. We also want to thank our friends at Are We Europe magazine for taking Katie in while she was in Brussels. Their latest magazine is all about the elections, but also not about the elections. You can check it out at areweeurope.com. And last but not least, everyone who took the time to speak to us in Brussels and beyond. This podcast was presented by Katie Lee and Dominic Kramer and edited by Katie Lee. Additional thanks to Katz Laszlo, Alex Climo and Thomas Lammers. We will be back next week with a normal episode, but we are making more of these special episodes. So if you have any questions that you'd like answering about the other EU institutions, then please do get in touch and we'll try our best to answer them. In the meantime, you can find us in many places online, Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram Europeans Podcast, Facebook The Europeans Podcast, or send us an email, europeanspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.